This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Whether it's interest rates, economic growth, employment, tax cuts, Social Security, or most recently the federal budget deficit, when Alan Greenspan talks, everybody pays attention. As chairman of the Federal Reserve, Greenspan controls some of the levers of the U.S. economy, but this Fed chairman's influence goes far beyond that of any of his predecessors. How come? Well, before we can understand the answer to that question, most of us have to learn a lot more about exactly what it is that the Federal Reserve does, its role in the economy, about the definitions of monetary and fiscal policy, and the distinction between the two. A little bit later in the program, we'll talk about Mr. Greenspan and his ideas, including what the New York Times recently described as an evolving theory about the level of debt. But we want to start with the origins of the Federal Reserve system, how and why it came to be, how it's changed, and how Alan Greenspan stands compared with previous chairmen. Later in the program, scholar Ian Baruma joins us to talk about the philosophy he calls Occidentalism, which underlies seemingly disparate attacks on the West and Western ideas, including those of Osama bin Laden. But first, welcome to Fed 101. What have you always wanted to know about the Federal Reserve and its chairman, but were too embarrassed to ask? And how is it that this unelected official wields so much power? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And Alan Meltzer joins us now. He's a professor of political economy at Carnegie Mellon University. He's been working on a two-volume history of the Federal Reserve since 1994. The first one, a history of the Federal Reserve 1913 to 1951. He's currently working on volume two. He's with us from his home in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be with you.
Why and when was the Federal Reserve created in the first place?
Well, it was created at the end of 1913 with a lot of effort by President Wilson. And the reason for creating it, there were a number. One was that there had been a number of very severe recessions with interest rates going up as high as 100% for very brief periods. And there was no effective mechanism for dealing with that problem at the time. So there was a general agreement that something needed to be done to smooth that process out. Second, there was a problem of moving crops. The U.S. at the turn of the 20th century was very much an agricultural country, and its big exports were things like cotton and wheat, and a lot of this came to market in the fall. The farmers, as a result, interest rates rose during that period because the farmers borrowed to hold on to their crops until they sold them, and much of that business was being done in London. The borrowing was being done in London.
Mm-hmm.
The result was that there was a coalition of two groups, bankers who wanted to get the business and farmers who wanted to get the loans. And they could agree that they wanted some way to smooth out interest rates, and that became the Federal Reserve.
Now, the issue of whether there should be a Bank of the United States, I mean, that goes back to what I guess the first Washington administration, and this was not a new issue. What took so long?
Well, it was always, there's a lot of populism in the country now. There was a lot of populism in the country then. So the Bank of the United States started, that was Alexander Hamilton's idea, and it was renewed once, and then it ran into a buzzsaw from President Jackson, who declared war on the bank and closed the bank down. So from 1836 to 1913, there was no central bank in the United States.
Now, how different was the original Federal Reserve system from the one we have today?
Very different. First of all, we were on the gold standard. And the people who designed the Federal Reserve System thought that the gold standard would take care of what we now think of as the principal macroeconomic policies. Therefore, what was the Federal Reserve supposed to do? Well, it was supposed to smooth interest rates during the year so as to help with the crop moving. But each one of the 12 Federal Reserve banks that were set up was considered semi-autonomous. It set its own discount rate, it had its own interest rates, it made its own rules to some extent, but there was a board in Washington that was supposed to supervise. That was a compromise between two very strongly held views that differed greatly. One was the view of the bankers in New York who wanted a central bank like the Bank of England controlled by bankers with no government interference. And the other group was a group of were many of the people who lived in the South and the West and the farmers who very much feared what would happen if there was a Wall Street bank that was setting interest rates. They thought that bank would squeeze the interest rates high and at their expense. So they wanted government control. And the only issue about the Federal Reserve was not whether we were going to have one, but it was who was going to control it. President Wilson came up with a compromise, which made the semi-autonomous banks with boards of directors that included local bankers to set rates under local conditions, and then a supervisory board in Washington that was supposed to look over the whole system. Now, exactly what look over the whole system comprised was a subject that became a matter of contention almost from the first day. And for the next 20 years off and on, they argued about it a lot as to who really controlled the system and who made the rules. That was changed in the New Deal days in 1933 and especially in 1935, where the power was shifted to Washington, to the Board of Governors.
If you have questions about the origins, purpose, function, and what it's for about the Federal Reserve, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, TOTN@NPR.org. We have a question from David in Jacksonville, Florida.
Well, this sort of plays into the comments just made by your speaker. Is the Federal Reserve truly a private organization, and are the directors, including Alan Greenspan, paid for out of private money?
Alan Meltzer?
No. It's largely a public institution. There is a vestige of stock outstanding that are owned by the banks, but it really doesn't have any important role. It's now a public institution. The members of the Board of Governors are appointed by the president and confirmed by Congress for 14-year terms. Staggered 14-year terms. They are all public servants, and there is no banker control of the system. Not certainly now.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
An important question. Now, what role did the Fed play during the Depression?
entirely passive role. It behaved with total error. It operated under a theory that simply said when people want to borrow, we will help them to borrow. And that was written into the law. It wasn't just idiocy on their part. And they followed that. So as long as the economy was moving down, they would look at each other, worry about how bad things were getting, and not do anything.
And so that was presumably why President Roosevelt reformed it in 1935.
That was certainly one of the reasons. And President Roosevelt had not many nice things to say about bankers.
Indeed, they didn't have very many nice things to say about him either.
That's right.
Now, we have to get to an important distinction in definition here. There is monetary policy, which is traditionally the preserve of the Federal Reserve, and fiscal policy, which is traditionally the reserve of the administration. What are they, and what's the difference between them?
Well, that's been a question which has vexed presidents. President Kennedy used to say that the way he kept them apart was he remembered that M for money also was M for Martin, who was at that time in the position that Alan Greenspan has now. But that doesn't work anymore. So we have to have something else. Fiscal policy has to do with setting tax rates and government spending. Monetary policy has to do with setting interest rates and growth in the money stock.
Obviously, those two things are somewhat related.
They're related because, of course, there is often pressure from the fiscal side on the monetary side. If the fiscal side runs a big deficit, they like the monetary side to be easy to keep interest rates low so that they can borrow at low cost. But that helps to produce inflation.
Now, traditionally, as I suggested just a moment ago, it was the Fed that was involved in monetary policy. How many dollars were they printed, basically?
That's correct.
And it left fiscal policy, taxing, and spending to Congress and the president.
That's right. But, of course, for the first 30, 40 years, we lived under the mystique of the balanced budget. That is, that the government's budget should always be balanced. And President Roosevelt was always castigated by the business community for running deficits. But, of course, we now run much bigger deficits than that, and no one seems to care very much other than to criticize the other side for having run them. But but the public doesn't seem to care very much, and we do run large deficits, but we don't finance them. That's the big difference between now and the 1960s and 70s. We don't finance them by an easy monetary policy.
What do you mean by an easy monetary policy?
Low interest rates and rapid money growth.
Don't we have low interest rates and rapid money growth right now?
We have low interest rates, but not rapid money growth. We have moderate money growth.
Okay. Here's an email question from Bert in Muskegon, Michigan. Doesn't the Constitution say Congress is to mint the money and run the money supply?
No, the Constitution says it does give Congress responsibility for coining money and regulating the value thereof. But they delegated that policy to the Federal Reserve. So they describe the Federal Reserve as an independent agency, but independent within the government. That is, it's subject to congressional control, and Congress can always change the rules, in principle, can always change the rules that the Federal Reserve operates under. Independence is a word that gets used in this very frequently and has changing meanings over the history of the Federal Reserve system. For example, during the 1960s and 70s, there was a major effort to coordinate what the government was doing with its budget, the fiscal side, with the monetary side, which led to the financing of a lot of the budget. And that produced a big inflation that the public didn't like, and we don't do that anymore.
Okay. Well, that brings us, I guess, to the last two chairmen of the Federal Reserve. The first is Paul Volcker, and he is best remembered for his struggle to control then the bugaboo of the American economy, inflation.
Yes. Well, these are the two best chairmen that the Federal Reserve has had in its history. One, because he had the courage to bring down the inflation rate from 10 or 12% to 3 or 4%, and the other, because he finished the job bringing it down from 4 to about 1 at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So they really brought us back to what people should and, for the most part, do want, which is a stable value of their money.
And we now have a Federal Reserve chairman in Mr. Greenspan who talks quite a bit, not just about monetary policy, but has entered the field of talking a lot about fiscal policy, too.
Yes. He follows in the line of several previous Federal Reserve chairmen who have certainly talked about fiscal policy. Back in the 1930s, Mariner Eccles, who was chairman of the Federal Reserve for quite a while, had no hesitation about being a White House advisor to the president, to testifying on fiscal matters. In fact, at one point, he got himself into a fair amount of trouble by proposing a type of tax that the Treasury didn't want.
Here's an email question from Sue Lewandowski. Your guest mentioned the Federal Reserve being on the gold standard during Wilson's era. So what is the standard backing the Fed now? What supports American the dollar?
Nothing. Confidence is the only answer. That is, the value of your dollar depends upon how many they put out and the willingness of other people to take them from you.
The faith and credit of the U.S. government, in other words.
Right. I mean, what it says is this dollar, it says on the dollar, this is exchangeable for convertible into $1 of lawful money. But $1 of lawful money is just another piece of green paper.
Alan Meltzer, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And good luck with the second volume.
Thank you. I'll need it.
Alan Meltzer is professor of political economy at Carnegie Mellon University, the author of The History of the Federal Reserve, Volume 1. As we just heard, he's working on Volume 2. He spoke with us from his home in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. When we come back from a short break, we're going to be talking about the evolution of the Federal Reserve and particularly about the role of Chairman Alan Greenspan. If you have questions, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And you can also send us email questions, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the purpose and the role of the Federal Reserve System and the impact of its current chairman, Alan Greenspan. If you have a question about how the Fed affects your money and your life, you're invited to join us. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. We're also talking about a lot of Alans today. Of course, Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. We were just talking with Alan Meltzer. Joining us now is Alan Blinder. He's a professor of economics at Princeton University, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve under Chairman Greenspan during the Clinton administration. He's with us from his office in Princeton, New Jersey. And nice of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Oh, my pleasure, Neil.
As a teacher and student of economics, how would you describe Alan Greenspan's style as chairman?
I think what you see in Greenspan is great subtlety, a great ability without wielding a heavy hand to get the committee, the Federal Open Market Committee, and the Fed more generally to do whatever he wants. And thirdly, I think you can't ignore, you should not ignore, the really incredible track record. I mean, this man has been right so many more times than he has been wrong. It's hard to believe that it's random.
Well, give us a for instance.
Well, I think the most people differ on this. I think the most spectacular success in Greenspan's period is perceiving way before almost anybody else did the acceleration of productivity growth that started in the mid-90s, which has a very important implication for the Fed, namely that the economy can grow a lot faster without causing inflation. And lots of people, the great majority of economists, were highly skeptical of this when Greenspan first started pushing that line, but he was 100% correct.
So the conventional response, would have been to put brakes on the economy, what, presumably by raising interest rates?
Absolutely. I mean, back in the 90s, Greenspan let the unemployment rate drift all the way down to 4%, a rate that most every economist a couple of years earlier would have said is completely unsustainable and would lead to accelerating inflation if we ever got there. Greenspan didn't believe that.
We want some callers involved in the conversation. Let's go to Chris, who's with us on the line from Modesto, California.
Hi, everybody. I just had my question answered about...
I'm sorry about that. Well, we're glad about it. Yeah.
But I got a follow-up. It's about the relationship between raising interest rates and unemployment. And since most people don't understand that, it seems to me that when politicians tell us that we can have 100% employment in the United States or that... everybody who wants a job can have a job. It really isn't true because when we dip below 4% or approach it, they raise interest rates and toss people out of work.
Is that accurate, Alan Blinder?
I think that's correct. It's basically correct. The issue here is the number, which your caller used the example 4%, as I had just used. Unemployment now is closer to 5.5%. Not so long ago, it was higher than that.
What's disturbing to me is that we have to have a core group of unemployed people in the United States. I mean, we can call them frictionally unemployed or what have you, but we do need an underclass, and we seem to get one, and then we blame them for not finding work or use them as scapegoats for social policies that we want to do away with. And it just upsets me that people don't know about that fact, and you know, by not knowing it, they go ahead and vote Republican.
Well, I think your caller is right to be upset by that. It does appear to be the case, based on decades of evidence, that there is some level of unemployment that is necessary, or even unavoidable, in a modern economy. How much that is remains controversial, but it sure isn't zero.
Is it the same people all the time, or is it at least partly what we call the churn? Some people lose jobs, some people get jobs.
No, there's a tremendous amount of churn. Fortunately, it's not the same people over time, but it is not a random selection of the population. Certain population groups, less educated, minority groups, both younger, very young, and very old workers, always have higher unemployment rates than others.
Last question, and I'll hang up. Do you guys ever talk about this in your Fed meetings? I mean, you know, you guys affect a lot of people when you have your meetings, and I just wonder if that even enters into the discussion. Thanks.
Well, the answer is sort of yes. There isn't much discussion that I've been privy to that's sort of on the question that you and I were just on, that is, who are these people that are unemployed? But the question about how much unemployment is necessary in order to stabilize inflation, that is, how low can you go, is a constant topic of discussion at the Fed almost all the time.
Now, the Fed sits at the center of a great information-gathering machine. All sorts of information about the American economy flows into the Fed.
That's correct. Almost everything you can imagine.
Like, give you know, what would surprise me, do you think?
What would surprise you? Well, the vast majority of it wouldn't surprise you because it's published statistics about the economy that mostly come from the government, come from the Labor Department, come from the Commerce Department. Some of it comes from the Fed. The Fed actually gathers it. What would surprise you? Alan Greenspan has Fed staff make direct inquiries, and some he makes himself, to business people, asking how their businesses are going, you know, this to take him beyond the statistics. The Fed has a quarterly survey of bank lending officers, asking them about how they're setting standards, how they're perceiving demand, is loan volume growing, things like that.
So Alan Greenspan might call up the chairman of Home Depot or A&P and say, how's business?
He might well. Yeah, I don't know if he calls those particular people.
I was just making those up.
Yeah. Absolutely, but he does call some.
Here's an email question from Shannon Halley. Is fiscal policy decided by the Treasury Department or the Council of Economic Advisers? What's the relationship between the Reserve and the Treasury and the Council? How political is this relationship? Also, she adds, I've heard a conspiracy theory. The Federal Reserve actually runs the entire world economy. Any thoughts about where that theory comes from?
Well, I think the theory probably comes from the immense power that Alan Greenspan. Let me try to take, you may have to review some of those questions.
All right.
First of all, fiscal policy is, in a real sense, made by the Congress. There's an old saying, and certainly not by the Council of Economic Advisers or the Treasury, there's an old saying that the president proposes and the Congress disposes. So in our form of government, the president, usually at the time of the annual budget, will propose a fiscal policy that is a plan for spending and taxes. More often than not, the Congress will change that before it's enacted into law. The Treasury and the Council of Economic Advisers are in advisory capacity to the president. That is, as he's formulating his notion of what he'd like to do, which he rarely gets 100%, he's talking to the Council of Economic Advisers and the Treasury. Now, how political are they? The Treasury is and must be political, but a good Treasury will not be only political. That is, a good Treasury will be giving the president lots of technocratic advice. But the Secretary of the Treasury and the people that are closest to him are, of course, political appointees. They serve as the pleasure of the president. They're part of the president's team.
Now, the president usually, when he comes into office, inherits the Federal Reserve chairman, right?
Almost always inherits the Federal Reserve chairman because the two terms, while they're both 4 years, do not coincide.
And the Federal Reserve chairman does not serve at the pleasure of the president.
He most emphatically does not. He has a 4-year term, and the president cannot remove him except for probably moral turpitude or something. It's never happened.
Let's get another caller on the line. Mike is with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yes. How can Alan Greenspan 2 months or 2 years ago tell us there was adequate money for a $1 trillion tax cut for the wealthy when now he comes back and says, no, in fact, we have to cut the Social Security now so that the little guy gets hurt?
Boy, I wish I could answer that question. I was speaking a few minutes ago about the fabulous track record that Alan Greenspan has amassed, but I was referring to monetary policy, his management of what the Federal Reserve actually manages. He, of course, doesn't manage tax policy or Social Security. Many of us, certainly including myself, thought that his enthusiastic endorsement of these very large tax cuts in 2001 was not advisable because we really couldn't afford. We could afford some tax cuts. After all, we had a surplus. But the magnitude of the permanent tax cuts that were proposed by the president and enacted by the Congress were, I think, and many economists think, irresponsible.
And that goes to the role of the Fed chairman. Some people say, you know, stick to monetary policy. Alan Greenspan talks about fiscal policy a lot.
Yeah, I think Alan Greenspan, by virtue of his longevity on the job, his success on the job, and how smart he is, has become the national guru on all subjects. You have to realize, in his defense, that sort of everybody in Congress, Republican or Democrat, is always trying to enlist Mr. Greenspan, often in the context of congressional testimony, on their side of any issue. Now, one possible position of the Fed chairman, which for some Fed chairmen in the past have taken, is, you know, I only talk about monetary policy. That has not been Alan Greenspan's position. He has deigned to dive into many, many debates that have nothing to do with monetary policy. I mean, but what should be realized is when he's doing that, he's not doing the job of the Federal Reserve chairman. He's, in some sense, serving as the national economic guru.
Mike, thanks for the question. And Alan Blinder, we appreciate your time.
You're most welcome.
Alan Blinder, professor of economics at Princeton University, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he was with us from his office in Princeton, New Jersey. And joining us now is James Grant. He's editor of Grant Interest Rate Observer, a bimonthly financial newsletter, the author of several books on financial history. He's at his office on Wall Street in New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Nice to be here.
So you've written, as we say, a lot about financial history. What do you think is the appropriate role of the Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve chairman?
It is not to be the national kibitzer. It's not to have an opinion on everything up to and perhaps including the American League designated hitter rule. I think that Alan Greenspan gradually and by degree has slipped into the role of the de facto chief of economic planning of the United States. It's a great personal irony. He came to Washington a quarter century ago or so under the imprimatur of Ayn Rand and a radical free market philosophy. And he has insinuated himself into a role not much different than that of the head of economic planning. And I think it's a role that no one can discharge, hence the failure of so many planned economies.
He has, as Alan Blinder says, certainly at least in monetary policy, proven very successful over the years.
Well, his record is mixed. He has been a voice for risk-taking and speculation. And then again, in his actions, he has been a force for the amelioration of risk, financed by the United States government. Let me try to explain.
Yeah, I wish you would.
He March 2000, Boston College Conference on the New Economy. Alan Greenspan sounds more like a Wall Street internet analyst than Henry Blodgett did. Very bullish, sees nothing to stop this. Then and in earlier junctures in the financial markets, he was cheering on the forces of speculation. But repeatedly during his tenure, he has intervened to make things right with markets. He has cut the funds rate at strategic moments to put down a foam on the runway of speculation, such as October 1998, long-term capital management blows up, the Fed brokers a rescue, and Alan Greenspan very artfully reduces the federal funds rate one afternoon on an options expiration day, and the stock market is up 7%. So Greenspan stands for free markets rhetorically. In practice, he has been a serial intervener and a force for the socialization of risk in financial markets. And this has created a terrific, what they call in the trade, moral hazard. That is, he has given people the strong impression that nothing terrible will happen to them in the stock market, in the bond market, in the foreign exchange market. And nobody is powerful enough to make good on that assurance.
We're talking with James Grant of the Grant Interest Rate Observer about the role of Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve System. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. Mike joins us from St. Louis.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Well, I'm so glad to hear Mr. Grant. He pretty much explained what I was trying to ask about was that whole amelioration of risk in a supposedly free market. We all should make our own risk, and what Alan Greenspan has done very artfully is prevented risk from exercising its effect on the market, except for the little guy. In other words, he's got his ear to the big business, and that's his interest, is to save that. That's what he knows, and so he has to, by nature, act as these business people do, and he sees the world in that way.
Well, I have to ask you both. I mean, I've got a lot of my retirement money in the stock market through one way or another. I don't want to take any risks.
Oh, well, you took risks, but you just didn't. I mean, you played the game. And that's the NASDAQ demonstrated the insane risk people were willing willing to take because no one said, this is crazy.
Now, irrational exuberance, I think, is
well,
the phrase.
Well, it was way beyond that.
Alan,
but my,
Alan
question, my question...
Alan Greenspan uttered the phrase irrational exuberance once in, what, the fall of 1996, was shouted down and at length bought into the notion of a new economy. There is no new economy. There is an economy. However, there is an economy new in the sense that the federales will be there to support markets as best they can once they begin to sag. And perhaps that is what is new, and that is what Alan Greenspan has promoted.
I've always had this notion about the Depression that it was much more severe because the Federal Reserve had just been around for a little while, and basically, I'm just wondering, did it create an imbalance on the plus side in the Roaring Twenties that the Federal Reserve at that time was unable to deal with on the backside? And that's my sense that what might have caused the Depression. I'm sure there's got to be some research done on
this. Yes, in fact, there is. There is a body of literature that does not get very much respect at Princeton or the mainstream of monetary thought. But it is, for example, Murray Rothbard wrote America's Great Depression, and he made that argument. There is a book on banking in the business cycle by a lead author named Phillips that came out in the, I guess, the early 40s. And, and the argument was exactly the one you have advanced, Mike, that the Fed suppressed interest rates in the late 20s, thereby subsidizing the boom, and the federal government, especially under Herbert Hoover, was instrumental in not allowing the bust to do its work quickly, but instead prolonged it, and thereby turning a normal cyclical downturn, as in 1920-21, into the Great Depression, or thereby certainly helping that tragedy to unfold.
Well, James Grant, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it. James Grant is editor of the bi-monthly financial newsletter, The Grant Interest Rate Observer, and he was with us from his office in New York City. When we come back from a break, we're going to be talking about a historical predecessor, a group of philosophical principles of Islamic militants. And this is a group of philosophical principles embraced by, among others, well, the Nazis, the Japanese militarists before the Second World War, and indeed some aspects of the Soviet Union. And this is about a theory called Occidentalism. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.